Welcome to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today John Dunning. Mr. Dunning and I will be discussing his new book, The Sign of the Book, which has recently been published by Scribner, the fourth in the Cliff Janeway series. And first of all, Mr. Dunning, thank you very much for appearing on the show.
Well, thank you.
John, when you started out with Book to Die in 1992, I remember I've been an avid collector for over 20 years, and I can remember the buzz that that book created. And it really, the story behind the book became a very fascinating story in and of itself, didn't it?
Yeah, I didn't expect that.
Now, I read the introduction to the Pocketbooks edition of Book to Die, where you did a kind of an update. I believe it was in 2000. You updated some of the statistics. What are the statistics right now in terms of how many hardcover printings and how many paperback editions have been done of Book to Die?
You know, I don't know exactly. I kind of keep my head down here in Denver, and I know that it's still, I think the fifth printing of Book to Die is still in print. The paperbacks, I don't know. It's probably in its 20s somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And
all I do, to tell you the truth, is I give the royalty receipts to my wife, and we cash the check, and I don't worry about too much.
Good.
Like that.
Now, John, one of the interesting things about the introduction you did to that Pocketbooks edition is that you explained the phenomena of Book to Die, and I would recommend to all the listeners that if you haven't read Book to Die, number one, that you read it in that the very nice paperback edition is very nice. But you mentioned some price points of Book to Die, and it's very interesting that it came out and it went through the wall price-wise, and I was doing a little homework last week, and I see that signed first editions are going from $750 to $1,750. So the prices continue to appreciate on that novel.
And well, whether they actually sell for $1,700 is another question. You know, when people say it goes for, all it takes to get a price like that is for somebody to put it on that for that price, and you know, $750 to $850. That's you can sell it for that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But $1,700, I think you'd have to have a special copy to do that.
Sure, John. When you started out with Book to Die, and as the novel has progressed through The Bookman's Wake, The Bookman's Promise, and now The Sign of the Book, all published by Scribner, how do you decide how much detail to bring into the story in terms of points, different printings? Is that just something that's kind of naturally comes from you, or does that take a lot of work on your part to figure out exactly how much you want to include?
You know, I don't do that. I don't actually decide anything. I start writing, and I kind of grope my way through it. I grope like in a brain fog. I tell you the truth, I look at it much like a lawyer would look at discovery. You start with an idea, and you kind of grope into it, and then you discover where it's going to go. Now, in my old life, you know, I wrote five books before Book to Die ever came to be published, and then I quit the book writing business when I couldn't sell anything, and went to work, opened my bookstore. I'm writing a very different kind of book now than I did then. At that time, I was outlining. I would outline a book like Denver, which was a big historical novel with 50 characters, and I would sit down and plot the book out, and then I would sit down and write the book that I had plotted. I don't do any of that now.
That's interesting. And we might mention that a couple of your books, one's nonfiction, one is a novel, 2 o'clock Eastern Wartime, have to do with your love of radio. And you had a show in Denver for, was it 25 years, John?
Off and on for 25 years. I was on four different radio stations here.
Okay. And if you would, you have been a bookseller. You had the old Algonquin books. And I would like to tell the listeners that it's a very interesting website that you can go to. It's www.oldalgonquin.com, and that information is on my website as well, John. And there's some great pictures of old-time radio personalities. And what is it that still draws you to that part of Americana?
Well, I don't not still driven to it. I haven't done much with radio now for 7 or 8 years, but I keep getting emails and letters about it. And when we started that web page, I was a good deal more ambitious then than I am now. I thought I would put little columns in there about points and about points on books and information and tips and things like that. But I soon found that I couldn't keep that up. I mean, to write a book takes all I've got. I mean, I get up here in the morning, and for the first, sometimes for the first part of the morning, I just sit here. I sit here and look at it, and then I'll try and retype the last page and rewrite it, and it can take me all day to get a couple of pages out of it. So I don't really have a lot of time to devote to the website. Now, even putting the pictures on, I've got hundreds of old-time radio stills, and just putting those on the net, my wife does it, but I have to pick them out and give them to her, and I wish I could say I was better at it than I am.
Mm-hmm. John, let's talk for a moment about the sign of the book, which is your most recent book, which is available in bookstores, and it's the fourth Cliff Janeway novel. And Aaron D'Angelo, his partner, is in it. And it takes place in Denver and also in Paradise, Colorado. And one of the things I find very interesting about all of your books, and I really liked about the sign of the book, is it really gives the reader an insider's look at how the book trade has changed. And Cliff is a little disillusioned and angry at times with some of the things that have happened. And when you started the sign of the book, what was going through your mind as this idea developed?
You know, this is kind of a difficult book to talk about.
It is.
If I talk about it much, I give away the plot.
Yeah, we don't want to do that.
You want me to do that?
No.
No?
No, I don't want to give away.
Even just telling you that it's about signed books is a giveaway of sorts. Mm-hmm. It doesn't give away the what happens in the book. I mean, the turn of events that and how it plays out, but that does tell you that it's about, can I say, forgeries?
Sure.
Sure, you know, I mean, even that. Books, what started that book is the fact that there are some book people today who can get books signed. I call it the Immaculate Inscription, where you have a book that is signed by a dead man and dated after he's been dead. Some of these guys are not very clever in how they do this stuff. I was in a town not too long ago, and there was a now I have no reason at all to suspect this guy. I mean, he was a nice bookseller, but he had a copy of The Town and the City by Jack Kerouac, and I asked if I could see it, and he said, oh, it's signed. And I took it out and looked at it, and it was on the front free end paper, I think. It said John Kerouac, which is what he went by then. And I looked at it, and I thought, you know, he wanted $3,000 for it. The book itself was not all that great. It was at a British edition, and it was okay. But the signature, I mean, you know that they say about these guys like that, he ain't signing any more of them.
Right.
And I thought, how can I know that he signed this?
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of thing is what made me write the sign of the book. I've seen my own signature forged.
Is that right?
And my signature isn't worth anything. I mean, I sign anything people put in front of me. If they can catch me and pin me down, I'll sign it.
That's interesting. Now, John, one of the things that Cliff Janeway, I think one of the compelling things about his character is, for people that are true book people, there's something about the hunt for finding rare or out-of-print books, which once it gets in your blood, there's no way you can get rid of it, is there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a great... It's better than fishing. And I've done a lot of fishing. When I was young, I went with my father, and I sat out on the creek for 10 hours trying to catch some hapless fish. And this has been likened to urban fishing, where you go hunting for books. I mean, now, I remember a bunch of us booksellers were having lunch one time, and all of a else were griping about how, oh, it isn't the same anymore, you can't find it, you can't find this, you can't find that. And I said, yeah, it's getting pretty bad. And when we got up, we left there. And this had never happened again in a million years, but we started across North Denver, and we passed this thrift store. And I said, let's go in and pull a big one out of there. And I walked in the door, and there were four Book Scouts in there. And I know them all. They know me. And everybody starts looking suspiciously at each other, and they were carrying books around in their arms. And the woman who brought the card out and put the books on the shelf was fierce. I mean, you didn't mess with her. You look over the top of her basket, she'd say, don't touch those till I put them out on the shelf. And boy, you back off fast, you know. And I saw her, she put it out, it was out before. It had been put out. A copy of Water is Wide by Pat Conroy.
Wow.
This is a $1,200 book. And it's just sitting up there, and I look over to Helen, my wife, and I said, that's a big one there. And she said, that's going to be a book club edition. And I said, no, you can tell after a while, you can look at a book, like the second printing of my novel, Denver, has dark paper-covered boards. The first printing has light tan cloth-covered spine.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it, and I said, this is not a book club edition. You could see it was the cloth-covered original. And then I said to her, but there was a second and third printing, I believe. And she said, well, you could open it up and see. And I took the book and I opened it, and it said first printing. And I said, oh, mama, you know. And the Book Scout, one of the Book Scouts came up to me, and he said, that was a good one, wasn't it? And I said, yeah, it was pretty good. And he said, how good was it? And I thought, he's going to hate me for this. But I had to tell him, he's going to go right home and look it up.
Sure.
It's about $1,000. I still have it. I haven't put it out for sale or anything. It's a very scarce book. He said to me, I've got five copies of The Prince of Tides. Pat Conroy, I've never been able to sell them. And I said, well, I have 250,000 copies of that printed.
Yes.
This is a real different thing. The whole thing is how many there are.
Yes, and one of the things that I like about Cliff Janeway was he starts his career as a policeman, but he's a bookman. You know, he's a bookman at heart. And tell us the difference, the listeners, between a bookman and a book scout.
A bookman and a bookseller?
No, a book scout.
Book scout.
Because your book scouts and your books are always very fascinating. Because I've run into, you know, hundreds of them over the years, and it's interesting, if you go to a church sale or a thrift shop or whatever, you'll often find people sitting on the floor just poring over books.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of a subculture, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And you know, there are some doctors who scout for books. I'm not considering them when I talk about book scouts.
Right.
I'm talking about the guys who try to make a living at it, and some of them really are kind of misfits, and they don't know what else to do in life, but they've learned what books are worth something, and they gravitate toward the good books when they go to this one guy. He became the model for my character who's killed in the first line of Book to Die. He would just be able to go into a room, a garage sale or a house sale, and go in there, and the books are on the left and the dirty clothes are on the right, and he'd go to left, and he'd find, and he was able to pick out. He's the one that walked into a yard one day, and the woman, and you always ask, you know, they're pulling out stuff, and she says, oh, you got any books? And she says, oh yeah, bring out those books. And her kid brings out like four boxes of Oz books in jackets from 35, 40 years ago. And that'll make your day. Something like that happens. He brought them to me, and I was glad he did, but I had to go to the bank to get the money to pay him.
Yeah, I can imagine that. And there's that thrill, is it's a rush that you get that's indescribable. Now, John, one of the things that I tend to see in the Janeway novels is, if you are a collector and if you like to buy books, it seems that one of the trends is that the truly rare books are the ones that are doing the best right now, aren't they?
The truly rare books?
I mean, the books, like you say, it depends on how many were printed, but it seems like the really expensive books, those seem to always do well.
Well, you know, I haven't had a store now for 10 years. I've been writing most of that time, and so I can't tell you from our Most of what we've got online are just the remnants of our bookstore. Mm-hmm. We don't have too much in the way of expensive books, but yeah, I think it's always been true that a really tough book, a really scarce book. Somebody told me one time, you'll never see a rare book. You'll spend your life in books, and you'll never see a truly rare book. But there's a lot of scarce books around. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of them. I mean, there's a lot of scarce books. But within their individual titles, there aren't that many of them. You know, like The Water Is Wide. You can find something like that. Book to Die is not a scarce book. It's just an expensive book.
Mm-hmm. John, how would you say that if a person is looking at a book collection, is there any way to kind of, is there an overall gauge of how books appreciate? Does it kind of go in tune with what the general economy is doing, do you think, in terms of how well a book, trying to sell book collections and that kind of thing becomes?
I think this goes right back to the size of the print run, the number that are available, and I think one of the things that happens so often now is a book like Cold Mountain will get published, and people will go nuts over it. They start asking $200 for it. That's what happened with that. $200 for Cold Mountain, and the ink is barely dry on the pages. This is what's called a hypermodern.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing you know, all those copies that we didn't know were there start coming out of the woodwork and flooding the market. It's all tied to what kind of demand there is, and how many there are.
Yeah, that's a very good example of a book that like you say, the print wasn't even dry, and I can remember seeing advanced copies and first editions coming out of the woodworks. And you have to be very careful that you buy the first printing of the first edition as well. We might want to tell people that.
And another thing that happens is that have a book like that, the author then writes a second book. Well, without casting any aspersions on Gooderson or David Gooderson, I'll just tell you that the second book, or the next book after Snow Falling on Cedars, was not that well received. And when that happens, it can affect the prices on the first book. The hypermodern game is not one that I really particularly like to play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a certain element of gambling about it, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, well, it always is.
Yeah. John, you mentioned on your homepage, and briefly when we chatted before the interview, that you had been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. And tell the listeners a little bit about how you found this out and how it's impacted your writing and your career.
You know, I'll never know how it impacted my life and my career because when I was growing up, nobody had ever heard of such a thing. My daughter was diagnosed with ADD, and she went to a school in Putney, Vermont, Landmark College. She had been on the verge of dropping out of high school. I did drop out of high school. And, I got more report cards that say John is capable of much better work. Why doesn't he buckle down and study? And when I was told that she had this, I thought, yeah, this is another one of these buzz things, and the doctor said to my daughter, he says, well, this is often inherited. It's because a lot of times comes from your parents. You might ask him before you get the words out of his mouth. She said, oh, it's my dad. No question, it's my dad. And he said, well, what does your dad do? And she said, he's a writer. And the doctor said, well, does he drink coffee in the morning? And she said, yeah. And does he drink orange juice? Sometimes. And the doctor gave her a little Ritalin tablet, and he said, tomorrow morning when your dad goes to work, tell him not to drink the coffee and not to drink the juice. Take this pill. And it was just unbelievable. I took this pill, and I had a vision of clarity that just extended all the way through the day. And suddenly I said, I got to get some of this stuff. So I went to the doctor, and he did a few tests on me, and he diagnosed me and gave me a prescription, and I started taking it. The trouble with Ritalin, for me at least, is that that first dose was very powerful, and after that, it had a diminishing effect. It was still worthwhile, but my blood pressure went up, and pressure has always been borderline normal anyway, so I had to take myself off of it.
So has it gotten better, John, would you say?
No, it doesn't get better. It's just, I start a book, but I'm aware of it now. Before, when I was writing 2 o'clock Eastern Wartime, which was a nightmare to get through. I mean, I just the pages would pile up. That was my last typewriter book.
Okay.
I long for the days of the typewriter. I don't like word processing. I don't even like the term. I think it's Jimmy Breslin that said potatoes ought to be processed, not words. But no, it doesn't. There are days when I call it brain fog. When I sit down here and I know I'm not hacking it. I'm just not getting it, you know. And then suddenly, at the end of the day, maybe I will write 2 or 3 pages, and I will be surprised at how well it works. I trust certain people. I trust my wife. She reads it. She says, "This is great, but you know, it could use a little bit of tweaking," and I tweak it. I have no fear of rewrite at all.
That's interesting. That's good to hear, because I too share your, I won't say aversion, but there's something nice about typewriters. And also I talk to a lot of writers that still write in longhand, their first draft, and it is difficult to kind of make that change into the word processing world. John, you've had a couple books out in the last 2 years, the Bookman's Promise and The Sign of the Book. Is Cliff Janeway, is the next work going to be a Cliff Janeway novel, have you decided?
Well, I'm trying to do something now with Janeway. I really resist the idea of doing a Janeway book every year, even though money-wise, that's the thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have you seen a writer start off like gangbusters? First book, first 2 books, first 3 books are great, and then he goes in the tank. And I think the reason for that is because they sign a contract for books and they can't produce them. They got all this money that's sitting out there, they've got to produce it.
Mm-hmm.
And my problem is that I like Janeway. Mm-hmm. And I want to keep liking him. In fact, some reviewer said on Sign of the Book, he said, "What are we to make of the fact that the author who normally shuns this kind of one-a-year production is now writing one book a year?" In fact, he doesn't know what he's talking about, because On the Air took me 7 or 8 or 9 years. That's a big nonfiction book that Oxford University Press published. It took me forever to get that book done. And Janeway just had to sit on it. I mean, I wrote The Bookman's Wake under a lot of pressure to get it out. And then I just had to let them wait until I got this Oxford book done, because I had a deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
And no, it wasn't as lucrative, but that's all right. I had to get it finished. And by the time 2 o'clock Eastern Wartime, I was telling you how difficult that was to write. By the time the 3 or 4 years, however long it took me to write that, were done, I was able to kind of slide back into Janeway and do The Bookman's Promise in a year. And then I was able to do The Sign of the Book in a year. And I'm hopeful that this thing I'm doing right now, I will be able to do it this year. But after that, I don't know. I will not sign a contract on a book before I've got a handle on it and have an idea what's going to happen, to whom, how, and how it's all going to play out. I think when you do that, you shortchange the reader and your character and yourself.
That's refreshing to hear.
Yeah, I hope I can stick to it.
Yeah, it seems
I mean,
like,
you know, you gotta pay off your house and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it sounds like Scribner. You have a very good relationship with Scribner. I know in the acknowledgments you're always highly praised their staff and the way they've handled you, and that must make it a little easier.
Oh, Scribner's great. Susan Moldau. It comes from the top down. Susan is the publisher. Janet Scribner, and she is wonderful. And Suzanne Kirk, who was my editor, she just retired. I mentioned in the sign of the book and the acknowledgement, without her, there would be no Janeway. Let me tell you something. When I turned in Book to Die, some people think that all I had to do was send it out. I waited a year and a half or 2 years to sell that book. It went around and around and around, and people had, they lined up to turn it down. They would say, all this book stuff in here, this is fascinating to us because we're in the business. But who among the readers out there is going to care? And I remember in total frustration turning to my wife one day and saying, I'll tell you what, if they ever do publish this, the book stuff is what's going to sell it. And that's what happened. I was really at the end of my rope. I just decided, I'm going to be a bookseller. I'm going to keep my store. And then Suzanne Kirk came out of the woodwork and bought it. And I couldn't believe it. And my agent called me and she said, at last I get to make one of these phone calls. And I said, don't tell me you sold that turkey. She said, well, A, it's not a turkey. And B, yes, I did. And C, don't send up any rockets yet because they're not going to pay you that much money. And I said, I don't care how much money they're going to pay me. I'm back in the game. Mm-hmm. You know, after more than 10 years, I'm suddenly, and then when the book got published, the whole print run, I couldn't believe it, the whole print run was gone on publication day. My wife said, well, let's get some and sell them here in the store. And I said, you know, we don't sell new books. And she said, well, I think we're going to sell this one. And we put the book in the store, and bang, our 20 copies were gone. And I said, oh, something's going on. And I got, and I didn't even know what hypermodern things were at that time, you know. And I called New York and I said, I need 25 or 50, whatever I asked them for, more copies. And they said, there aren't any more. And I said, I'm sorry, what, did you say there aren't any more? And she said, second printing comes off in 5 weeks or something like that. She said, I can send you some men. And I said, I don't want any second printings. I got to have first edition. And luckily, there was an area rep, Terry Warnick, here in Denver, who said, I'll get you some. And she said, she got me a case. And I buried him deep.
That's a wonderful story.
Oh, yeah. Well, then I went to a signing out of the B. Dalton store out in the mall. And I forgot to mention this. The woman who called and asked me to come, she said, would you come to the B. Dalton's and do a signing? And I said, yeah. And I said, boy, that's a nice British accent you've got. And she said, it's Scottish, actually. And I said, oh, there's a Scottish woman in my book. The ill-fated Miss Pride. And she said, yeah, that was me. She said, and what you did to me in that book, she said, even going to work for B. Dalton's was not that bad. And I went out there, and they had a pile of first editions on the table. And I sat there at the front of the mall, and they'd come by and scratch me behind the ears and look and wonder what I'm doing there. They didn't sell a single book. And Miss Pride came up to me and said, I'm sorry we didn't sell any of your books. And I said, that's all right, because you know what? I'm going to take them all. And I grabbed them up like that. And they looked at me like, gosh, I've seen author egomania before, but never anything like this. But I got them. It makes a nice gift to somebody I care about, you know.
Absolutely.
I don't sell them. I just, if I like somebody and I've got an extra copy, I give it to them.
That's great. A true bookman.
Yeah.
I understand. I remember one time, it was a few years ago, I saw a stack of A Drink Before the War by Dennis Lehane, all pristine first editions for $4.98 on the sale table, and I thought I was going to have a heart attack, you know, because you can't believe your good fortune, and you look for the remainder marks and all that kind of stuff, and they're not there, and it's just all of a sudden you're in heaven.
That happens.
It does happen. Well, John, I want to thank you very much for your time today, and I'm glad to know that Miss Pride still, at least at that point in time, survives, because she was a character I was particularly fond of.
Yeah, her name was Vanilla.
That's a great name. And I can't stress to the listeners enough that if you love books, you'll love John Dunning, his Cliff Janeway, because it really gives the reader an insight into the world of books, which I think is unique in the fictional world, particularly in the mystery crime genre. John, and I'm so glad that the Cliff Janeway is still around and kicking, and I wish you nothing but the best of luck going forward.
Well, thank you very much.